current state on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up later this hour, it's Wednesday, which means our Neighbors in Action segment is up and ready to go. Betsy Miner Swartz of the Gift of Life, the organ donation program, joins us for that. And today, the new fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, or DSM-5, as it's more commonly known, comes out. The Bible of Psychiatry is what it's also referred to, and we will have a segment on that. What's in it and what's new? At the top of the show today, elected officials in Lansing are nearing the end of their annual give and take over the city's next budget. By a 5-3 vote Monday night, the city council approved a roughly $115 million spending plan that eliminated a number of items supported by Mayor Virge Bernero. The mayor has promised a veto. Here to talk about what he can and cannot accept and about several developments that have unfolded just in the past 12 to 18 hours, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero. Nice to see you.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
Glad you're here today.
I hear your staff told me no four-letter words, and there you go talking about veto.
That's one four-letter word we can say on current state. I had more questions involving the budget alone than we probably had time for, but I feel obligated to address General Motors' Lansing Grand River expansion. This is a logistics center, as I understand, that will add about 200 jobs. What triggered this?
Well, right now, somewhat, we have to speculate. I mean, we do know this, Mark, that the Camaro is coming to Lansing, right?
Yes.
I mean, that announcement's been made. So that's a huge thing to get a new vehicle. And of course, we're already producing award-winning vehicles, the Cadillac CTS, the Cadillac ATS, which I think is going to work, the new Cadillac CTS, which is astounding. But, you know, we've had Car of the Year the last couple years out of Lansing. So we're producing some of the leaders of the GM fleet. That's phenomenal because of the great job that our GM UAW workers do. And it's largely because of their reputation, the job they do, their productivity, Mark. I mean, we should take it. It's worth taking a moment to pat ourselves on the back. In the hyper-competitive world that is the auto industry, we're producing some of the greatest cars in the world right here in Lansing. And so I think because of that, when GM made the decision to bring the Camaro back to this country, Lansing stood out like a beacon. And so here we are, we're getting the Camaro. So one could surmise that this logistics center has to do with preparing for that, because right next door will be where the production of the new line of the Camaro will go in.
Okay.
So we're talking about 200 jobs. We're talking about $44 million of investment of construction and so on. So it's a phenomenal investment. It's a great thing. The reverberating effects of this, I call it the magic of manufacturing. I get very excited about it. But the magic of manufacturing is the spinoff of it, because when you think about manufacturing, experts say that for every one manufacturing job, we're talking about 200 new manufacturing jobs. Experts say that for every one manufacturing job, you get an additional 5 to 7 in the economy, because of the reverberate, the ripple effect of those jobs, because you have a supply chain.
How big a revenue impact here?
It's millions. It's millions. I don't have the exact number. We were just calculating that. It's the reverberating effect is phenomenal. You know, you look at what goes into a car. You look at the windshield, you know, the glass, the tire, the components. Now, they're not all made in Lansing, but there's a supply chain, the trucking, the advertising, you know, the sales. So it's a phenomenal thing. It's a great omen for the city. It means GM is doubling down on their investment, you know, more than doubling, really. So it's very exciting. And again, it speaks to the workforce. Any mayor would be proud, would be delighted to have them. We're very lucky that they are making their home in Lansing, and we are leading the state's recovery. We're one of the great manufacturing hubs of this country in Lansing. And the statistics showed that even before this, the manufacturing growth in Lansing is like second in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's the top in Michigan, and it's second in the nation.
In East Lansing last night, the city council approved federal money earmarked to expand Michigan Flyer bus service from East Lansing to Detroit. To be clear, this still has to be approved by the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. My question for you, as a supporter of the Capital Region International Airport, how much impact would this expanded service have on CREA?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a supporter of subsidizing the Flyer. And we call it the Flyer. We should stop the misnomer, okay? I'm not in favor of subsidizing bus service to Metro Airport. I think this is absolute nonsense.
Why not?
Horse hockey. It's insanity. Because we pay, Mark, if you live in Ingham County, you are paying for the Capital Region International Airport. Okay, you're paying for it. It's in your millage. You're paying. The county has levied an assessment to pay for the regional airport. So why in the world would we then take public money and give it to a for-profit, out-of-state company, Indian Trails? That's what we're talking about. And this never went out for bid. You know, something's up here. Something's fishy. This never went out for bid. If we were going to use public money to subsidize for-profit bus service, this is a for-profit bus company, Indian Trails, an out-of-state company that got a sweetheart deal, that got a no-bid contract. If you were going to award something like this, by the way, we have Kelly Dean. We have Dean Transportation based right here in the Lansing area, okay? So if you want to subsidize bus, then put out a bid, let everybody compete for it. And, you know, I believe in buy local, Mark. We have a buy local ordinance in the city. You know, we give a 5% preference for local companies. If we were going to subsidize bus service, we should give it to a Michigan company, provided that they gave a reasonable bid. But of course, Dean Transportation never had a chance to bid on this. And that's not the sole reason I oppose it. I'm just telling you, something's fishy with this thing. It just doesn't make sense that we're using public funds to support an airport here in Lansing, and then we're subsidizing bus trips to Metro Airport in Detroit.
It seems like it's a priority of the federal government, though, nationally, to try to expand transportation options in this way.
Well, we ought to be – it's nonsense. It's ridiculous. You know, you go to Europe, you go to other places that are going concerned. They have what's called rail. Now, I know this is a new concept in Michigan. Other people have trains. Rail transportation, Mark. That's public transportation. Nobody really wants to take a bus. Okay, people do occasionally take a bus because they have to. But let's get serious. If we're going to be spending millions of dollars over time, let's beef up Amtrak. Let's get real rail transportation. This is nonsense. Like, people want to be bussed around. And the fact is, we have an airport right here. Now, if people want to take Indian Trails to Detroit as a bus, by the way, this is America. Go ahead and take it. My gosh, vote with your pocketbook. Spend your money how you see fit. Don't ask me to subsidize a for-profit bus company. This is absolute garbage. And I intend to fight it every step of the way. I'm going to fight it at the state level, the federal level. This is the kind of grant that is ridiculous. It makes no sense. Our roads are crumbling. Our rail is failing increasingly. Amtrak is in trouble. And we're subsidizing for-profit bus operations. Insanity.
Onto the budget. As I understand it, you can veto the entire plan or you can do line item vetoes. Do you know which one of those it'll be?
It'll be line item vetoes.
Okay. Council wants the Board of Water and Light to bump its payments to the city. I forget the exact percentage. Is it a percent? Maybe you know.
We have not cleared that up yet. It's somewhere between 1 and 1.2. So in other words, it would go from a 5% return on equity to 6 or 6.1 or 6.2, somewhere between 6 and 6.2. Somewhere around $4 million that we would get back.
Not only does this undo your original plan to increase light and water fees for residents, but it's a specific idea, if memory serves, that you were against a year or even less ago. What has changed?
Well, let me say, this shows you how compromising and flexible I am, Mark.
Okay.
Tell us more. I am willing to consider this, okay? Because the reality here is what we're talking about. So on the big picture, actually, what you're talking about is the most important part of the budget. And on this, we actually agree, the council and the mayor. I want to get the job done. The point is, we needed new revenue for the streetlights and the hydrants. We need new money for that. And on this, we agree with the board, the council. Now, the council chose to do it a different way. I proposed a special assessment in my budget to them.
Right.
They essentially are saying we can raise the same money in a different way, which, as you're correct, last year I said no. But, you know, politics is about the art of the possible. We have to get this done. It's important to the budget. The council almost unanimously said they'd like to go with this return on equity approach as opposed to the special assessment approach of getting the money to keep the streetlights on. The goal is we have to keep the city safe, we have to keep the streetlights on, and we have to get new funding for it. To the average public, Mark, it makes little difference. To the average public, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. The question is how they're going to end up paying for this, and one way or the other, they're going to pay for it. The reality is, unfortunately, we have to essentially go to the taxpayer, go to the residents, and say we need more. We have to have a way to subsidize this in the budget. We can no longer simply take it out of the general fund, and the money will be there. On that, we agree. There are a number of specific items in the budget that I disagree with them on. They're really small comparatively. The reality is, on the great bulk of the $114 million budget, we are in agreement.
Any response from the Board of Water and Light regarding that?
I'm just beginning my talks with them.
Okay. Monday night, you made it clear that funding for economic development that the council dropped was really important to the administration. You're going to restore that then?
Yes. The majority of the council, once again, is out to lunch on economic development matters. You know, praise.
How does that play out? Talk to us about the council's attitude toward economic development and how it differs from your own. What's the big takeaway there?
Well, it's theirs is passive-aggressive, and mine is aggressively pro-business. Theirs is passive aggressive.
What is it?
They're passive aggressive. They for example, they want to raid the economic development fund right now. They propose in their budget, I think it's like $1 million. They're trying to take out of economic development when it's unnecessary and it's counterproductive. And you're really eating your young when you do that. One of the reasons that we're doing well, we talked about manufacturing, but we're doing well in bioscience. We're doing well in insurance. You know, we've got growth across the board in Lansing in tough times because we never stopped investing. We never stopped working. Now they want to hobble our EDC and take money away. I'm not going to allow that. That's insanity. But I say they're passive aggressive because in the past, for example, Brian Jeffries has supported these efforts. He's constantly talking about the TIFA, the problem in the TIFA. Well, when he was on the EDC board, he voted for all those things. He's trying to say that I gave away money to he voted for those projects, okay? But now he's against them. You know, he was for them before he was against them. So, you know, we need a pro-business council. You know, you can't be pro-labor without being pro-business. And I'm proudly both. I am pro-labor, no question about it, but I'm pro-business. There has to be balance. Yeah, they've done that, which is short-sighted. They want to eliminate the sister cities, which is a pittance in the budget, and it's out of my budget. You know, this is the thing, Mark. It's an overreach. This is a problem you get into with Kara Wood. She's president of the council. She's finally running something. And look out, because she's a control freak, and she wants to run my budget. My mayor's budget, which is where the faith-based comes out of and the global initiatives, is lower than Tony Benavides when he was here. You know, I'm operating at the same level that Hollister was. So they ought to stay out of my budget, take care of their own, we can move forward.
The economic development amount, you're not going for a smaller amount. You're going for the full whatever was in there originally.
They're not going to touch economic development. Not on my watch.
Okay.
We're not going to slow down. We're not going to wave the white flag. We need to be doing more. We need to be investing. And the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, Mark. You can look at Jackson National Life. You can look at General Motors. You can look at the successes we've had. The NAPS building downtown. Those projects would not be happening if we didn't have the robust economic development efforts that we have in place. And I'm not going to sacrifice, and I'm not going to compromise that.
You mentioned the sister cities appropriations and the faith-based initiatives money here just a second.
Which comes out of my mayor's budget.
Those come out of your office's
yes.
budget.
And I challenge you to look at any city our size, Mark. I'll put my budget up against a mayor of any city our size. We are very frugal in the mayor's office, and those are wise investments. The sister cities, this isn't just social, cultural, and educational, which on their own is important. We don't fund the whole office. They raise other money, but we have a protocol officer that works in the mayor's office, and it's absolutely vital. We just had a Japanese delegation in. They planted some trees along the river. But beyond that, the Consul General Matsuda came in from Detroit. He brought with him, Mark, I can show you the list of who was here, presidents, CEOs, vice presidents of some of the top Japanese-American companies in the nation, in the state, were here. And by the way, our number one trading partner is Japan. In Michigan. It ain't Canada, it's Japan. And we had some of the top business leaders in town because of a sister city's mission. We're the capital city. We are constantly hosting delegations from around the world, not just around the world. We just had a Turkish delegation. We've had European delegations again and again. We have to be prepared to welcome them and be appropriate. And it's a pittance of a budget that we do for that.
On the heels of the financial health team's recommendations, though, especially, why not make, I mean, Brian Jeffries was on the show yesterday calling for them to be privatized. On the heels of the financial health team recommendations especially, why not make those public private sector projects?
For 8 years, I've battled Brian Jeffries and Carol Wood. I've had them throwing up obstacles, and I've done the best I can to turn those obstacles into stepping stones. You know, when I was an altar boy, Father Rubinsky used to say, "We all have our cross to bear, Virgil," and he is so right.
One council member who often supports you, Jessica Yorko, is facing significant competition in the 4th Ward this fall. How concerned are you that you could lose her?
I'm not too concerned. Jessica Yorko is outstanding. We don't always agree. She's a very strong spirit, very strong-willed, and intelligent person. But so we don't always agree on everything. But, yes, she's a solid supporter for a balanced pro-business, pro-labor approach and a progressive approach to politics and to policy.
And you're confident she'll prevail
yes,
in the 4th?
Yes, people in the 4th Ward know Jessica. She's just a phenomenal. She's an unstoppable force. She's a great addition to the council. She's a real pro, and I can't believe they're gonna come close to touching her.
One development yesterday here that in the Capitol I want to ask you about. The final Senate budget includes a 4.8% increase earmarked for revenue sharing with municipalities. You've railed against these cuts to revenue sharing.
Maybe they got the message.
Okay.
Gosh, that gives me hope. That reminds me of all the preaching I used to do to my kids, and you wonder sometimes if they're listening. Maybe the legislature was listening.
Did you know about that?
No, thank you for the news.
That was not in the House budget, but it is in the Senate budget.
I hope it makes it through. I hope it makes it through because our cities are hurting. As we talked about before the show, Mark, our cities are in jeopardy. We don't have time to talk about that now, but, man, cities everywhere are put upon. And it's not like in other countries. You know, in other countries, most of the budget goes to federal government and local government and less to the state or what's called the provincial level of government in other areas. Here, we have the federal government, the state government, and by the time the money trickles down to us, a lot of times there's not much left, particularly when you talk about roads. And you know, we're where the rubber hits the road in local government. When people call 911, they're calling us. They're not calling the state capitol. When people need their roads plowed, when they need their potholes filled, they're calling us. When the sidewalks are heaving and crumbling, and we do not have adequate funds. We are creatures of the state. In Michigan, cities are creatures of the state, and we are not treated very well.
The State House is discussing tighter local restrictions on fireworks use. This is in terms, I think, of the hours that fireworks could be set off. Where is that topic in Lansing right now, and would you favor tighter restrictions on fireworks?
Well, what's happened, Mark, the biggest problem, see, you can make all the restrictions you want. Again, please apply the speech I just gave. We don't have the money, okay? It's about enforcement. You can pass any ordinance you want. You can say you can't spit on the sidewalk, you can't do this, you can't do that. If I don't have officers to enforce that, if I don't have the time and the ability to enforce it, it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And so people use fireworks, and they've made certain fireworks legal. Okay, the legislature did that recently. They made more of a panoply of fireworks available to the public. Now they want to close the barn door after the horse got out and come by and say, oh, but you can only use them at this time and that time. Guess who gets to enforce that, Mark? Us, local government, with no more money. And here's the real kicker. They are collecting, the state, millions of dollars in taxes on these fireworks, none of which we are getting. The state fire marshal is enhancing, you can check this out, they're enhancing their budget by millions of dollars. Not a dime of that, other than maybe in this 4% increase to the revenue sharing, is trickling down to us. We're the ones that have to enforce their law. And so you asked about Lansing. The city council already passed something, I think, saying that you can only use these fireworks the day before, the day of, and the day after a holiday, including the 4th of July.
Okay.
Now, but now it falls on me to try to enforce that, which is essentially a joke, because I do not have the money or resources. We have to go out and keep people safe. And what happens is those calls for noise typically will not be a priority call. We will try to get to them. We will certainly, but around the fireworks time, you know, we're going to be busy dealing with higher priority calls in all likelihood. I need something from the state out of those millions of dollars. They should give the bigger cities some dollars specifically earmarked to firework enforcement. And I'd be happy to go out and enforce it. I think people should have a good time, but they should do it responsibly. And, you know, after I guess you'd have to say after midnight, because people want to do it when it's dark. But certainly after midnight, we need to have a zero tolerance policy. And I'm not sure that I have sufficient law enforcement capacity to enforce that.
I got to get your take on the surplus that was just reported a couple of days ago on the state level here, just to continue the state budget. The targets committee or whatever it's called met yesterday. I believe the way it broke down, $350 million for roads, $150 million for education, and I forget if it was $25 or $50 million for the rainy day fund. Any particular response to those priorities and those sums?
Well, I mean, again, Mark, I just tell you, I talk to mayors, I read about it in other countries. We have our priorities screwed up generally here. We do not provide the level of coverage, the level of service, the level of funding at the local level. The federal government and the state government eat up most of our taxes. Local government, which is the government that is trusted the most, which does most of the heavy lifting, the quality of life issues that matter are at the local level. And when people want their streets plowed, their potholes filled, their 911 calls answered, that falls on me. And all I've had is cuts. I've had reductions in property taxes, an income tax that is flat and basically regular cuts in revenue sharing. So, you know, two of the three legs of the stool have been hobbled. Cities are ailing. And look at this picture, Mark. You've got cities turning to emergency managers. You've got cities essentially veering toward bankruptcy and a state that says, oh, we've got a surplus. Well, of course, you've been starving your children, your creatures. You've been starving city governments all these years, and now you have a surplus. Isn't that dandy? So I'm not going to argue about their – I'm not a state legislator, but I'm here at the local level trying to – you know, survive, dealing with these FHT, and trying to grow and thrive, by the way. But, Mark, I'd like to do more than survive. I'd like to thrive. And where is the plan? Where is the urban agenda?
But roads are definitely a priority of yours.
Yes.
I mean, education is too. Of I don't know if any money should go in the rainy day fund or not, but I mean, there's some
kind of payoff. You have to have a certain rainy day fund for your bond, your credit rating and all that. I'm not going to argue about that. But I'm just saying they got to be realistic and they got to consider that local government is where the rubber hits the road.
And increase revenue sharing.
Well, yes, but also beyond that, I'm not just asking for more money. I've said this again and again, Mark. We got to be more productive. We got to have a system that we got to have less duplication. And see, we've got county government. We didn't talk about county government. You got city, county, school district, state. What does county government do? Why don't we rely on county government more? Why don't they empower county government? In other, I'm not saying that the city is the end all. Okay, I'm just saying city services matter. And we have all this government. We could be working more cooperatively and collaboratively. And that's going to have to, I think, be mandated. Or certainly more facilitated by the state, because local governments do not work very well together. There is a lot of duplication, a lot of separateness, separate police department, fire department, even court system. Did you see the reaction in East Lansing when one of the judges proposed that we have a consolidated courts? And East Lansing right away said, oh, we don't want any part of that. We want our own court system. Really? You got to have your own court? There is a whole lot more we could be doing with collaboration, and I think a lot of that could be done through county government. I think a lot of big, expensive services could be done at the county level, because county government is the sweet spot that is both local and regional. We need more regional government, less duplication.
We've been talking with Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero about the fiscal year 2014 budget, state spending, fireworks, you name it. Virge Bernero, thanks very much.
Great to talk to you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Today, the new fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, or DSM-5, as it's more commonly known, comes out. Often called the Bible of Psychiatry, the new 947-page manual outlines diagnoses for hundreds of mental disorders. Published by the American Psychiatric Association, the manual is broadly influential, affecting mental health professionals, insurance companies, the court system, and pharmaceutical and mental health research, to name just a few. It's also not without its share of controversy. The director of the National Institutes of Mental Health even came out earlier this month to say they will ignore it. Chris Hopwood is an assistant professor of psychology at Michigan State University and is conducting training workshops for the American Psychological Association on the new DSM-5. Current State producer Joe Lindstroth sat down with him to discuss the changes and the controversy surrounding the book, which is the first edition in nearly 20 years. Dr. Hopwood began by explaining the book's significant influence.
Insurance companies organize their billing codes for mental health around the DSM. Researchers, including pharmaceutical and other kinds of researchers, tend to organize their research around the DSM because it provides a common language. The DSM was originally developed in the 50s at a time when researchers and practitioners would use the same words to mean very different things. So if I said schizophrenia, it's not clear that you would know what I was talking about. And so one of the real virtues of the DSM is it provides a common language for people from very different backgrounds, social workers, psychiatrists, researchers, clinicians, patients, funding agencies, all to have the sort of common idea for what we're talking about when we're talking about mental disorder.
The book hasn't been revised since the mid-90s. What are some of the more important changes in your view in this new edition?
One of the big changes has to do with the way the diagnosis is actually written. In the DSM-3 and 4, which were the previous two editions, and they were largely similar, the DSM-3 having come out in 1980, the diagnosis was established along five different axes. The first axis was what we normally think of, mental health problems like depression. The second axis was things that were thought to be more enduring, like personality disorders or mental retardation. The third axis had to do with medical syndromes that might be part of the picture. The fourth axis had to do with social or other kinds of things going on in a person's environment that might impact functioning. And the last one was an overall functioning scale. So as you can tell, that's a little bit complicated.
Quite.
Right. And so what they've done is they've collapsed the first three axes so that there's basically one diagnosis. And that's actually the way it happens in the rest of medicine. And so the idea here is to bring it in line with the way it works in the rest of medicine. If you go to your oncologist or any other kind of physician, you get one diagnosis, and that's really it.
There are some changes due to specific
right.
diagnoses, like autism, for example.
That's right. Yeah, I guess I would classify those changes into a couple of different categories. One category is where they've collapsed diagnoses, and autism is a great example of that. There used to be three similar kinds of diagnoses in the DSM-4. They were autism, Asperger's disorder, which is sort of like autism, but it's less severe, and there's less in the way of language problems that are typically associated with autism, and then pervasive developmental disorder, which is kind of more sort of a wastebasket category for people who don't quite meet criteria for one of the other two. Research suggests that all three of those things are really one common dimension, and that they distinguish levels of severity on that dimension rather than different kinds of people per se. And so they've collapsed in the DSM that diagnosis into one autism spectrum dimension. Another example where they've collapsed is that in the DSM-4 there was substance dependence and substance use, abuse. And so, for example, with alcohol, you could have alcohol abuse, which means that you use alcohol, maybe get in some trouble using alcohol. Dependence, on the other hand, is distinguished by tolerance and withdrawal symptoms, so the need for cravings, the need to drink, for example, in the morning. There's another example where abuse seems to be more about a less severe version of dependence rather than a different kind of disorder per se, and so they've collapsed those two.
Is that going to change how treatment centers then diagnose whether, you know, put the threshold about whether a patient is eligible for their services?
That's right. I mean, that's one of the comments that I get from people I talk to in the substance use area is that a lot of their triage decisions, when they decide to triage a patient to one kind of service or another, have largely been based on the distinction between dependence and abuse. And so those systems will have to become accustomed to a new system for doing that. You know, the DSM is a big change, and people get very used to thinking along the lines of the DSM. You know, I myself was trained in the DSM-4. That's the way I was trained to think about psychopathology, and I think all of us are going to have to get used to some of the changes before we can really determine whether they were good ideas or bad.
Now, the DSM-5 has received quite a bit of criticism.
That's right.
The director of the National Institute for Mental Health, Thomas Insel, even came out a few weeks ago disparaging its contents and announcing that the Institute will just flat out ignore it. How damaging is that to the credibility of the DSM?
Well, you know, for a long time, the NIMH and the APA have sort of been in lockstep. They've really been complementary, and that's really useful because when you organize a research study around the DSM categories, you have a decent shot at NIMH if it's a good study of getting funded. And so divorcing those two, you know, you risk losing credibility for the DSM, and maybe that's part of the point that Insel's trying to make. And just decoupling, it risks decoupling practice from research, which I think is always sort of dangerous. I can see Insel's point to the extent that we know pretty certainly now that there's not such a thing as a diagnostic category per se. That is, it's not true that you can find one group of people who have a disorder and one group of people who don't. Rather, the symptoms of mental disorder are distributed in all people. Some of us get sad sometimes, some of us don't. And where you draw the line between a person with a disorder and a person without, in fact, is somewhat arbitrary, right? And there are more evidence-based ways of thinking about these kinds of problems that haven't been incorporated into the DSM. I think where I sort of disagree with Insel is that, first of all, I mean, he talks about biology and biomarkers, and the truth is we're just not there for clinical practice. So, you know, if he shows me how to use a spinal tap and a blood draw to diagnose my patients, I'd be open to hearing that. But the truth is right now we're not ready for that quite yet. And so, you know, research-wise, yeah, I think that's a good priority. In clinical practice, we're just not ready for that.
It seems absence another alternative by just taking away the DSM-5, as flawed as it may be, leaves clinicians like yourself without that common language.
That's right. That's what we really have to have.
Are we still? Is it too early to see what this impact, this division, will have on psychiatry and psychology?
I think so. I think in general, it'll be interesting to see what the role of the DSM is moving forward.
There are other criticisms. Mm-hmm. Some have said that this was rushed, albeit 15 years in the making. There's not enough scientific data for some of these diagnoses. The APA, the American Psychiatric Association, makes money off of this book. Those are a couple highlighted ones.
That's right.
Can you speak more about those?
It's a very difficult process, right? The APA, I think, spent $25 million or so, as I recall, on this process. And, my own personal opinion is it's fair to try to recoup your money in such an investment. Now, how much you should make is a different question. I don't know. Certainly, the issue of conflict of interest is something that's important and needs to be thought of about carefully. I think in general, in terms of moving things too quickly and the scientific evidence, I agree with you. 15 years is a long time to wait for a new manual, right? And there are some changes that I think have been a long time coming that we needed to change. You could always say, well, we need more information, or you could always say we need the manual to come sooner. And so I think no matter when the thing came out, probably people would be criticizing in both directions on that particular point.
There's something that seems trivial, but it's actually not. Up until this latest edition, the DSM-5, the number was a Roman numeral.
That's right.
And now they're using the number 5. What is the significance of that?
Yeah, it's actually not trivial, and it speaks to the question that you just asked me previously, which is that the idea is that it could be more responsive to research as it comes along. So if there was a major finding in some area of psychopathology that needed to be incorporated into the manual, and we didn't want to wait another 15 years to incorporate it, the idea is that 5.0 could become 5.1, so that change could be implemented more readily, and that we could have 5.1, 5.2, et cetera, before we have to get to 6.
There's more than science, it seems, that goes into the DSM. Cultural values, social norms inevitably play a role. Mm-hmm. I think homosexuality is a prime example of this. Mm-hmm. What happened with homosexuality?
Well, obviously, our culture has changed a lot around the issue of homosexuality over the last 50 years or so. And, in the previous editions of the DSM, it was pathologized as a mental disorder. So you could get a diagnosis if you were homosexual. That changed with the DSM-3, and it's no longer the case. But that's a good example of where various cultural factors influence the kinds of diagnoses that get listed. A more contemporary example is internet gaming disorder, right? And so obviously in the 50s, that wouldn't have been a reasonable diagnosis. But nowadays, the internet's an important part of all of our lives, and people can use it pathologically. So that raises questions. If disorders are truly ultimately biological in a sort of simple world where there's either biology or not biology, the fact that culture influences diagnoses would seem to be problematic. On the other hand, mental health doesn't work that way. You can't reduce everything to biology, nor could you ever ignore biology. And so the truth is that the DSM has to be responsive to what's happening in culture at any given time.
With this new edition, are there any new disorders?
Yeah, there's every edition has sort of disorders that are close to the line of making the cut, and there's a couple that made the cut this year that are new. One of them is gambling disorder. And so this is regarded as similar to any other sort of addictive disorder, one of the sort of like the substance use disorders. Another one is a disorder of childhood called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which involves children that are early school age, I think 6 to 10 or so, who have sort of chronic negative moods along with a lot of temper outbursts, sort of difficult to manage kids. I think this was a response in part to what many regarded as the overdiagnosis of childhood bipolar disorder in children. And so this provides maybe a different kind of category for capturing those kinds of children who we don't really know if they're going to end up being bipolar or depressed or what later in life.
Critics might argue that's just another reason to medicate more of our children.
That's exactly right. That's been the criticism. I would say if in fact this reduces the likelihood that children will be diagnosed with childhood bipolar disorder. I mean, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder typically comes with a medical treatment that's pretty severe and profound. And so it could actually change the kind of pharmaceuticals that are used for those kinds of children. But anytime you add a disorder, you may include a larger group of people who would meet criteria for disorder, and it could increase the treatments for those disorders, obviously. There's no real valid place to draw a line between disorder and non-disorder, and there's strengths and weaknesses to drawing lines at different places. So if you include more people in a diagnostic category, you risk labeling, you risk over-pathologizing, you risk over-medicating, but you include more people who are suffering for services.
Who can qualify.
Who could qualify
help.
For exactly. On the other hand, if you make it more exclusive, then you lower the risk for stigma and over-medication, et cetera, but now you've reduced the possibility that people who might need help would be able to get it. And so, you know, again, it's another example of where this could be a more nuanced conversation, I think, than are we over-pathologizing or under-pathologizing? And really, without the idea of values being in that conversation, we're going to get a little lost, I think.
Now, backing up, with all of this, these criticisms, you have the National Institute for Mental Health, the director, coming out and basically saying he's going to ignore the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of critics of psychiatry out there
who
call it a pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Do these criticisms, does this prop up that argument, in your view?
Probably so, yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, what is inescapable about mental health practice is that there's values involved. You know, when a patient comes to me, I have to make a decision about whether I think that this patient is having the kinds of problems that merit treatment. I have to make a decision about whether I think I would be an appropriate person to provide that kind of help. And I have to make a decision about whether I should bill for that kind of help, right? And all of those decisions, in part, are informed by values. And I think if we take disorders too concretely, if we think of depression like we think of a quark, then we lose a lot of important information, right? And the fact is, people with the same experiences could be more or less depressed. People with the same temperaments could be more or less depressed depending on their experiences, et cetera. So the truth is there's a lot of judgment in there. Now, does that mean that it's pseudoscientific to make those judgments? No, I would say, in fact, there's strong evidence that these things have biological correlates, that they relate to dysfunction, that they cost our society a lot of money, that it makes good sense to try to treat people with mental health conditions, that they keep the public safe, et cetera. And so I think if you sort of dichotomize into is it a real science or a non-science, you lose a lot of important information. It leads to a sort of unsophisticated conversation.
Well, it seems like we accept not perfect science in other areas, meteorology,
sure.
Some of these things where we are just making our best guess with the
That's
tools
right.
that we have. And, of course, everyone jokes about the meteorologist being wrong often. But,
sure.
But truly, how accurate are psychiatric diagnoses? Are they any less accurate than any other medical diagnosis?
Those are two very different questions, actually. And the answer to the first one, how accurate are they? Not very. And the answer to the second one, how similar are they to medical diagnoses? About the same. The truth is that no medical diagnoses are all that accurate. Some of the field trial results that came out in the American Journal of Psychiatry sort of showed that the reliability of some of the psychiatric diagnoses were pretty low. The agreements were in the 0.4s after adjusting for chance. So meaning that we'd agree with each other less than half of the time about a patient's diagnosis after you correct for
wow.
chance agreement, right? And that sounds pretty bad until you realize that's actually the standard for most medical diagnoses, which is sort of scary when you think about it. But it doesn't set psychiatry apart any relative to the other fields of medicine anyway.
How useful is the DSM for mm-hmm. you? Do you use mm-hmm. it?
I use it for certain things. I think it's a useful way to train practicing students, because that, again, provides a language that they can share with all of their colleagues. It's a useful way to communicate with people across disciplines. Ultimately, if I'm assessing a patient for psychotherapy, for example, or for some kind of consultation, I will certainly include DSM categories in the chart and diagnosis in the chart, but you have to go much beyond an assessment of the diagnostic criteria in order to provide a useful assessment of what's happening in a person's life. You have to get a sense of what their family's like, what they're coming in for, how they experience their problems, et cetera. And so it certainly falls short of what I would regard as a thorough clinical assessment. But in terms of doing what it's meant to do, which is to communicate information to colleagues and to patients, I think you could do worse.
Chris Hopwood is an MSU assistant professor of psychology and has been conducting workshops for the American Psychological Association on the 5th edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM-5, which is being released today. Thank you, Chris, for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
For Current State, I'm Joe Lindstroth.
It's Wednesday, and it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature the Gift of Life, which facilitates organ donorship in Michigan. Here to tell us more about Gift of Life is the organization's communication specialist, Betsy Miner-Swartz. Hi, Betsy.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for being here. And joining her is Patty Jo Herndon, president of the Michigan Donor Family Council and a sister of an organ donor. Welcome, Patty.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us, Betsy, tell us more about Gift of Life and what you do and how you operate.
We help donors fulfill their wishes. So we work statewide. We're a nonprofit. We are the link between hospitals and transplant centers. So we go into hospitals when someone is in a place where organ donation is potential, and we talk with families. We also work with the hospital and the transplant centers to help facilitate the organ donation and get the organs and tissue where they need to be. Okay. So, transplant centers.
You work primarily with donors, though. And how does the recipient, how does that play out?
Yeah, we're absolutely on the donor end.
Okay.
So then we work with the transplant centers to work the match and find the recipients that should receive the organs, and we help the transplant centers get the organs there. So,
how much participation is there in Michigan in organ donorship? Is there a shortage? Is it adequate? How do you?
Yes, there's a shortage, and no, it isn't adequate. So we have a couple things going on that that we hope will correct themselves at some point. We have an increase in the number of people waiting in Michigan for organ transplants. So, say, like in 2006, about 2,600 people were waiting. And this week we're touching 3,150 people who need some sort of a life-saving transplant. At the same time, number of donors statewide and nationwide actually are decreasing. So we have sort of two things going on at once that aren't great.
Increased demand and decreased supply.
Absolutely.
Patty Jo, you had to make the decision to donate your sister's organs. Tell us about that.
My sister was 38 years old. Her name's Ellen Sullivan, and she'd been suffering from headaches, but she hadn't gone to the doctors. And one day she was found unconscious in her home, and we rushed her to the hospital, and it was discovered she had a brain aneurysm. The doctors recommended that she be airlifted to one of two hospitals. And in the meantime, while they were making those arrangements, she took a turn for the worse, and she had no brain activity. And so she had not signed up on the registry, but she had mentioned a couple months prior to that to us that if anything ever happened to her, that she would like to donate her organs. She had seen a piece on the news one day, and she wanted to do that.
Okay.
So, of course, we fulfilled her wish. It was difficult because you're sitting in an emergency room learning that your sister's dying and that she's not going to make it, and you're having to make that decision.
Of course.
So it's in terms of making that decision ahead of time, you're giving your family a gift by saying, yes, I'd like to be a donor and sign up on the registry, so that takes that out of their hands. They don't have to deal with that at the moment. But my sister saved and enhanced a lot of lives. She had four small children when she died that my husband and I raised with our children. And everyone in my family does everything we can to share our story and let everyone know that my sister and all other donors are heroes because they saved lives. The way I look at it for my sister is she taught me a lot of things during my life, how to be a good person, how to be a good parent. But in the final moments of her life, she unselfishly made a decision to save other lives. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a bigger hero than that.
There are these magical connections that exist between donors and recipients, Betsy Miner-Swartz. Tell us about one of them that you're aware of.
Magical connections?
Yes.
Are you talking about like families that meet their recipients?
Yeah.
Well, we've had, it's possible, and it happens every day, for donor families and recipients to meet. We have a there's a woman named Barb Gerber, whose daughter was killed in Toronto, and she was a donor. Barb was able to meet her daughter's heart recipient and
put her heart to the chest.
Barb did put her heart to the chest
and heard her daughter's heart beating.
Again.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, and honestly, heart recipients and families, that happens a lot. It happens a lot where the heartbeat is heard again. And for those families, it helps them heal and get through their grief so much easier.
Tell us more about the what organs are in most demand.
Kidneys are in the most demand. About 80% of the people who are on a waiting list in this country are waiting for kidneys.
And what accounts for the increasing demand and the decreasing, more importantly, I suppose, the decreasing supply?
Well, the increasing demand probably is because of the decreasing supply. The other thing that's going on nationwide is there's a lot of hypertension and obesity. A lot of that is taking its toll on kidneys, people's kidneys and pancreas. A lot of those health issues that are going on all over the place are really adding numbers to the waiting list. So the other thing that's going on is there are fewer donors all over the country. It's hard to put your finger exactly on the reason for that, but there's some thought that doctors are doing a better job saving lives today than ever before.
Oh, okay.
So that makes sense.
Patty Jo, have you established a connection with any of the recipients of your sister's organs?
No, unfortunately, we haven't. We have had an opportunity to meet many recipients. They weren't my sister's recipients, but it warmed our hearts as well as my sister's children's heart, because you see people who take this gift they've received and they live an incredibly good life, and they make sure they give back to their communities in every way they can. Obviously, promoting organ donation as well as just being wonderful citizens. So they enhance our communities every single day.
In situations like Patty Jo's, Betsy, where there was this sudden, serious medical emergency, and Patty Jo could testify to the fact that her sister had talked about organ donation, how complicated does that scenario get in an emergency situation? It sounds really stressful. But are hospitals accustomed to dealing with this?
Yeah, they are. And it's not really complicated. I mean, I guess it can be in specific situations where family members don't necessarily aren't all on the same page. But it's emotional, and it's emotion on top of emotion for those families.
Sure.
We have Gift of Life has a staff of trained nurses and other medical professionals who go out into the hospitals every single day and talk with families. So they're really, really good at listening and understanding and helping families make the best decision for them.
Patty Jo, tell me about what are the common concerns you're aware of that make people hesitate with regard to organ donation?
I think the biggest one, and I hear this a lot, is that doctor, if you have the heart on your driver's license, once you sign up on the registry, you'll have a heart on your Michigan driver's license. That indicates that you have signed up on the organ donor registry. And a lot of people think that if a doctor knows that their wish is to become an organ donor, that they won't do everything they can to save their lives, which is absolutely not true. If that were true, I wouldn't be sitting here today promoting this, because I saw what these doctors went through when my sister died and the nursing staff. When my sister died, they did everything they could to save her life. When I walked out of the room after saying goodbye to my sister, obviously she was already dead. She had no brain activity, but the machines were keeping her alive.
Mm-hmm.
When I walked out of the room, the doctor, the 7 interns, and all the nurses were literally standing there waiting for me. They held my hand and said, "What an incredible gift I had just given at such a terrible time in my life," which was true, obviously. they were devastated and crying that they could not save her life. Obviously, it's doctors take an oath to save an individual's life. Secondly, they're people with emotions. They felt what we were losing. At the same time, they knew they were able to save other lives, but that wasn't their goal. They're a completely separate team of doctors who save your life as to the transplant physicians. That's a federal law. They can't be working together on that.
Okay.
So that's what I usually tell people, unless Betsy wants to add something to that. That's what I explain to people. It's two separate sets of physicians, so they don't work together to say, well, I need this organ, those kinds of things. The first set does everything they can to save that person's life. If I didn't believe that 120%, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Number one myth.
It is.
Okay. Which you just talked about. They won't save my life if they know I'm an organ donor.
How about that? Betsy Miner-Swartz, how is Gift of Life funded?
We are funded. We get some Medicare dollars. We're a nonprofit. We're the only organ recovery organization in the state of Michigan. So we work for the state, and other states have a similar Gift of Life Michigan.
How do people get involved?
Get involved.
How can they support you in any way?
Sign up on the registry.
Okay, actually sign up for organ donation.
You can go to the Secretary of State office. You can go to giftoflifemichigan.org. If you don't have a red heart emblem on your license, get one today. We don't need money. We need people to make decisions to save others' lives.
Betsy Miner-Swartz is the communication specialist for Gift of Life. We were also joined by Patty Jo Herndon, the sister of an organ donor and president of the Michigan Donor Family Council. Betsy and Patty Jo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work, and we just don't know about them. If you'd like to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Coming up Thursday on Current State, Interim Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski talks about his new position. We also take a look at artist and teacher Carl Goode's first art exhibit in over 20 years. All that and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Current State's producer is Jolynn Straw. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.